book deal with the spiritual malady, the unmanageability, the second half of step one. And they don't know where in the book to look. And we found three specific pages that deal with the unmanageability, the spiritual malady, and untreated alcoholism, which I believe are all three the same thing. And we're going to use all of page 44 and half of page 45 and a middle paragraph on page 52 to look at the third part of step one. So for your own view of this, just picture the first half of step one in your mind, the way it's written in the short form on page 59. We admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, dash, that our lives had become unmanageable. I thought the dash meant fill in the blank. And I thought it meant fill in the blank with whatever's true for you, and here's what was true for me, and the way I wanted to write it. Yes, I admit that I'm powerless over alcohol and drugs, and that's why my life has become unmanageable. So now that I'm not drinking or using anymore, everything should be just fine. Thank you very much. Because I didn't know, I thought that the unmanageability was connected to being powerless over alcohol. And I thought my life was unmanageable when I was drinking. And now that I'm not drinking anymore, I should be able to manage it, until I saw the second half of step one has nothing to do with the first half of step one, unless you're still drinking. Now that you're sober, the dash means these are two separate ideas, that I'm powerless over alcohol and my life has become unmanageable, sober. There's a thing you've heard whenever you hear more about alcohol. In California, they read so much at the beginning of the meeting, it's all lost its meaning. And they read so much that they read more about alcoholism. And in there, you'll always hear the delusion that we are like other people, or presently, maybe, presently, my life is unmanageable. I would hate to say to you, but I would also, I got to take that one step further. I would hate to say to you that I'm 13 years sober and I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable. That's my problem. If that's the problem, where have I been brought in 13 years? I have power over alcohol and my life is manageable, and I better know who that power comes from, because I ain't drinking and I got power to manage my life. How do I do that? So I need to remember where that power comes from. But if I was powerless over alcohol, I would be in the other half of this room tonight rather than in this part of the room. And if my life was unmanageable, I wouldn't be able to tell Leon 6 months ago, I will be in Battle Creek on Friday night, October, whatever this is, Friday the 13th, right? And if I was still in superstition, I wouldn't be here on Friday the 13th, especially in Battle Creek, Michigan, with a few of you that are in this room. I wouldn't be... So we're going to take the first step in three parts. Let's take it like this. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, body and mind, dash, that our lives had become unmanageable, spirit. So we'll break it down in those three parts starting tomorrow morning. But tonight, I'd like to talk about the difference between drug addiction and alcoholism.
Let me say one thing to address what he's talking about. I want you all to consider looking at that from the state you're going to be in tomorrow morning. The state you're going to be in tomorrow morning. Okay, we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. This for me, when I go back through the steps, when I look at the allergy of the body, yeah, you better believe I got to go back into me and my drinking. When I look at the obsession of the mind, the unmanageability of my life, I better be looking at it from right now today. I mean, there's this thing going on. The way we're going, half the country will be on Prozac pretty soon. My experience with depression, it was a manifestation of a spiritual malady. And when I did this work, God treated that. So when you come in tomorrow morning and we look at that, I want you to consider the idea that we're going to look at being mentally powerless tomorrow morning in the state we're in and the unmanageability right now. You see?
You got people that are alcoholic, you got people that are addict, and you got people that are both. That doesn't mean they're the same. We're going to take the criteria that we're going to use from the doctor's opinion to the top of 23 to look at the craving. And I want you each in your own way to look at the craving with alcohol separately from the craving with drugs. And just look at when it was you and booze. Did this craving happen? When you put alcohol in your system, did you crave more alcohol? Then I want you to look at the craving with drugs. And here's what I find, because I'm going to, as we go through this right now, I'm going to share the truth that I found. Because I did heroin for several years, and I shot cocaine for several years, and I did more drugs than some of you in this room that are real addicts. And I'm not an addict. And I'll tell you how I came to this. See, me saying that my length of time with drugs or the amount that I did makes me an addict would be like you saying, because you drank a lot, you're alcoholic. Well, we're going to find in here a guy that's described as a hard drinker who's over there in that bar right now tonight, who can drink tremendous amounts of booze, can drink some of us under the table. It might gradually impair him physically and mentally. It might even cause him to die a few years before his time. And he has a habit for alcohol, has a habit, very interesting word the book uses, has a habit for alcohol badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally, but he's not an alkie. Because all he needs is a sufficient reason, make up his mind, ill health, falling in love, like my dad, the warning of a doctor, change of environment, this man can stop. Then we have a real alcoholic, who might not even be as bad as the guy over there who could drink some of us under the table, might not even be as bad as the continuous hard drinker, but at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose control over the amount once he starts. He gets this craving, and a sufficient reason by itself would not be enough to keep him sober. He can't make up his mind about alcoholism. And my God, some of the ways we hear alcoholism referred to nowadays in AA, they make it sound like this disease is something you can make up your own mind about. Where I live in Southern California, in all these meetings you hear, we just don't drink no matter what. I mean, if I could just not drink no matter what, why would I be here tonight? I would be home in Santa Monica on the beach doing wonderful things for myself, just not drinking no matter what. It's almost the opposite. I'm here because I drink no matter what. Not because I can't drink, because I drink no matter what, right?
Let your experience show you your truth, you see.
So, in going through the craving, I saw the craving for drugs and I saw the craving for alcohol. So far, I'm an addict. Then we get to the obsession. And all that has to do with is one question. Write down this one question, which is really what the top of 23 says. I'll read it the way the top of 23 says, because a good textbook is going to end up with a summary on this part of the disease. And what the top of 23 says, if turned into a question, and we needed to probably say that's the most important principle we're going to use with this book from now on, once we get to the doctor's opinion, we're going to turn every statement we possibly can into a question for you. And at the top of 23, if you turn it into a question, the way it's read will be like this. Does your experience abundantly confirm that once you put alcohol in your system, something happens which makes it virtually impossible for you to stop? You'll find that from the bottom of 22 to the top of 23, if turned into a question. So all you need to be clear on to go past page 23 with booze is, does your experience with alcohol confirm that once you put it in your system, you lose control over the amount and you cannot tell when you're going to stop, when that craving's going to stop? And if you want to break it down to a simpler question, here it is. Do you lose control over the amount once you start? So I look at that with booze, and I look at that with drugs, and I see that so far, I'm an alcoholic addict because I get the craving for both alcohol and drugs. Now we get to the obsession, and the obsession has to do with, can you keep yourself stopped once you stop? And you'll find the bottom of 43 sums it all up at the end of that section. It sums it up by saying, at a certain time, there will be no defense against taking that first drink. You won't be able to keep yourself stopped, and the power of God needs to be there. And neither you nor any other human being is going to be able to provide that defense. It must come from a higher power. In the short form, the question would be, can you control the stop once you've stopped? Can you keep yourself stopped? Would even be the shorter question. So all you need to be convinced of in looking at the obsession is, can you on your own power without God keep yourself stopped? And here's what I came to. I woke up one day and decided I never wanted to shoot heroin ever again. I walked away from it and I never shot heroin ever again on my own power without help or God. I then got involved in cocaine, and some people would say, well, you're just an addict that went to another drug. Not true. I woke up one day and I said, I don't like the way this stuff is making me feel. I'm not ever going to do cocaine ever again. I share that with a real addict. He says, man, I did that 100,000 times, and I couldn't stay stopped. I walked away from heroin and cocaine when I made up my mind to, and never needed any help and couldn't quit drinking for 18 years. Not an addict. That's all that I used. I get the craving, because most addictive drugs will give even my mother a craving. She's not an addict. My mother's freebase is a little cocaine. She's going to crave a little bit more, but she's never going to do that ever again. She's going to make up her mind. And I've sat with real addicts. Here's another example. Guy comes over to my house. He says, I'm 7.5 years in the program, and I'm an alcoholic addict, and I want to do this work. I said, great, let's do the work. We get into the doctor's opinion. He comes back the next week. He says, man, I need to tell you something. What's in that doctor's opinion does not happen to me with alcohol, but it does with freebase cocaine. I said, how come you've been saying you're an alcoholic for 7.5 years? And he said the saddest thing I've ever heard, to be that long sober. I could see 7.5 days. 7.5 years, he said, the reason I've been saying alcoholic for 7.5 years is because they told me I am. And I thought, my God, nobody ever gave you the grace and dignity to find out your own truth. And he found out his own truth, and he had a reason to do the work. He's an addict. He's about as much alcoholic as the man in the moon. If both were the same, how come there's all these alkies that can take or leave drugs? If they're both the same. And how come if they're both the same, there's all these addicts that can take or leave alcohol? That doesn't mean we give permission to addicts to drink booze and not get away with doing drugs. Because if they drink booze, they're going to go to what they really like. And that doesn't mean we're giving alkies permission to do drugs. Because when they do drugs, they go to what they really like.
What they have no choice over.
And you're going to hear this stuff in AA where people will say, my drug of choice was cocaine. Next time you hear someone say that, ask them, is it possible that the drug you think you was your drug of choice was your drug of no choice? And you'll see that this idea of choice is one more idea that's been filtered into our program that by people who don't care about us, who aren't our friends.
How many of you have sat in meetings and said, use this phrase, my drug of choice is? Raise your hands. Okay, I'll have you consider that that's your drug of no choice. If it was your drug of choice, why in the hell are you at the meeting? Just choose not to use it. It's your drug of no choice. I'll tell you what my drug of choice is. It's Excedrin. I can buy as much of it as I want. I won't hide it from anybody. If I take two and don't like the results, I will never buy it again. I'm like Joe. I have a 20-year history with alcohol and a 13-year history with dope. Did so much cocaine one night that I went into respiratory failure. They had to jam a needle full of nitro in my heart. And here's what I did. They took me on a flight for life ride. I was in the hospital 5 days. I get out. I still remember walking out the front door of the hospital. I put my hand in the door. Here's what my head says. We lived through that. Let's go get a drink. Now, I've done about every kind of drug you can do, but I woke up one day and said, for me, drugs were alcohol enhancers. And I woke up one day and said, I'm never doing drugs again. Now, I have a physical craving. You put any kind of drug in my body, but I do not have a mental obsession because I woke up one day without God and said, I'm not ever doing that crap again. I don't like what it does, and I've never done it since. I am an alcoholic who is powerless over where drugs will take me if I put them in my body.
And being powerless over drugs is not the same as being a drug addict. And being powerless over where alcohol takes you is not the same as being an alcoholic where you crave more booze. Here's the analogy that freed me up. Follow me on this. Take you and a normal drinker that you can think of. I always think of my mother because she can have a drink and a half. Or I think of my girlfriend. She can have a drink and a half, which I cannot comprehend. Right? I heard a lady the other night in a meeting. She said, I'm alcoholic because I know the price of a drink in a bar. And I thought, I no more relate to that than the man in the moon. I have never had a drink in a bar, and I do not know the price of a drink in a bar because I gave it all up. I was also at a meeting last week, and I thought it was interesting, and I had to comment in the meeting. Somebody said, put the price of a drink in our meeting basket. And I got up to speak, and I said, you might as well just start putting the deed to the house, the title to the car, the family, the friends, the money, right? Put the price of a drink in the basket? I'm sorry, I don't have it. Never did have the price of a drink, right? So here's the analogy. Think of you, a non-alcoholic that you can think of, a normal drinker, and 98 other people from anywhere in the world that you want to pick. Put them all in a log cabin for 500 days and shoot them with heroin 3 times a day. How many of those 100 people, including the non-alcoholic, my mother, how many of those people will be physically addicted to the drug heroin after 500 days? Mm-hmm. Every one of them. Now hold back their shot for 5 or 10 hours. What happens to every one of them? Craving, withdrawal, whatever you want to call it. Now give them a shot of their drug. What happens to their craving?
Goes away.
Goes away. They use words like you got well, got sick, the bogs off, whatever you... I got well. Right? I know the terms, right? Now, let's take me, my mother, and 98 other people from anywhere in the world and put them in a log cabin for 500 days and pump as much alcohol as you could pump into somebody through every orifice that you could possibly pump it in for 500 days. How many of those 100 people are going to be alcoholic? Every one of them? There's a difference. 10%. That's what statistics say. Would we have made my mother, who's not an alcoholic, into an alcoholic? You either are or you aren't. Okay, and then my sponsor says, now we got to find a way to get those that aren't out. And he says, you tell them, anybody that wants to leave can leave, and everybody that wants a lease on the place can stay. Right?
So 90 of those 100 are going to leave, and 10 of us want to marry the person that put us in there. The real alcoholic.
So we got the non-alkies out of there, and we got the 10 alkies. Hold back their booze for 8 or 10 hours. What happens to every one of them? Withdrawal, craving, whatever you want to call it. Maybe to different degrees. Some might go into DT, some might shake, some might be obsessed, some might just be uncomfortable. But they're all going to go into withdrawal. Now give them their drug. What happens to their craving? What happens to your craving? There's a difference.
Exactly.
We just found about 4 differences between an alcoholic and an addict. The basis of these programs, NA, CA, AA, is one alcoholic talking to another or one addict talking to another. You put an addict across the table from an alkie, and he starts talking about getting well after he puts his drug in his system, the alkie's going to sit there and say, something ain't right. I don't identify with you. Drug talk doesn't work for an alkie. Drug talk starts talking to an alkie, you lose him. He's gone. He doesn't feel right in the very place where he belongs.
I heard this the other day, and I looked at my experience, and it was my truth. And this is what I heard. The addict does dope to escape from reality, and I drank alcohol to try and live in reality. There's a lot of differences. I don't know. It's been said that a treatment center with one van started the idea that alcoholism and drug addiction are the same. I don't know that, but I believe you better take a look
He's
at
cold.
It. I believe you better. Now, I work at a treatment center, too. I believe you better take a look at that. Am I an alcoholic? Am I an addict? I challenge you to look at the belief system. If you're sitting in this room and never really looked at it, if you just bought somebody's story, the book gives you a very clear way, Joe went through it, to find out, am I an alcoholic, am I a drug addict, am I a both? I mean, I sat in AA for 3 years telling you I'm an alcoholic in Andon. I remember one time Don said to me, Mark, are you a good sign painter? And I said, no. He said, well, why don't you introduce yourself as an alcoholic addict and a shitty sign painter? And I knew him well enough to know he was making a point. I said, what's your point? He said, my point is this is Alcoholics Anonymous. Why don't you show some respect for it? This is singleness of purpose. He said, I don't think you even know what you are, which irritated me, but it was the truth, you see.
Read what Bill wrote. Read what Bill wrote in Problems Other Than Alcoholism. Read what Bill wrote in Open and Closed Meetings, the difference between the two. Because there's no addict in the world that's not welcome in any open AA meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I believe if you're not alcoholic, You don't belong where they should at least be respectful. And I heard a guy in California say one time to me, he came into my living room and he said, in Alcoholics Anonymous, in a closed meeting, I say alcoholic out of respect because I know I'm an addict. And I said, you're not doing that out of respect. You're doing that out of disrespect. It's terribly disrespectful because the guy that might need to hear somebody might get lost when he hears you. I was in a meeting one time, and they didn't introduce themselves at the beginning of the meeting, nor did they really talk about the substance they were talking about. And I listened to this man talk about his problem, and I wasn't sure what he was talking about, but I really related, and I walked up to him afterwards, and he said, oh, I'm not alcoholic. I have a problem with sugar, but I just love coming to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, my God, what if my life was on the line? I also was in a meeting not too long ago where they had nothing on the wall, no book. I walked in a little late, which I usually don't do and I don't like to do. And they weren't introducing themselves. They were just sharing. And after about 20 minutes, I wonder, is this a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? And somebody shared and she said, you know, I think I'm the most selfish, self-centered person in the room. And they started to debate. No, I am. No, I am. And I absolutely knew I was in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Only in AA would people find virtue in being the most selfish, self-centered person. I mean, imagine a Lions Club meeting or an Elks Club or the Rotary or a Women's Club, and they get virtue out of, I'm the most selfish, self-centered person in the room. It wouldn't fly, right? Only in AA would that be a topic for conversation. No, I'm the most selfish, self-centered person in the room.
Today
we can stop there.
Yeah.
We had some opening comments and some stuff to get off of our mind, and basically we've covered from the title page up to the doctor's opinion. And for lack of a better way, we'll break the book into pieces or sections. We've basically covered section one, which is not step one yet. It was just some great general information about the program. We talked about the title page. We talked about a three-part program, Unity, Recovery, and Service. We talked a little bit about a three-part disease, which we're going to cover this morning, which is the first step, body, mind, and spirit. We talked about a part of the program for each part of the disease. Bring the body to the fellowship. Bring your mind to the recovery process. Bring your awakened spirit to be of service in the program and in the world, and that becomes one. We talked about a program with 36 spiritual principles, 12 traditions, 12 steps, and 12 concepts. They gave us three legacies. When I found that out at 6 months, it opened the whole program up to me, and I found out I wasn't in it. I was in one third of it. We talked about the table of contents and basically the pages we're going to use to look at the first step, which we'll cover this morning, where you find the second step, where you find steps 3 and 4, where you find steps 5 through 11, and chapters that can be used to look at step 12. We talked about the preface. This being a textbook, we talked about growth from 39 to 55 in the fellowship and how it grew. We talked about the main purpose of this book is to show other alcoholics precisely how to recover. We talked about recovered. We talked about questions that are current myths in Alcoholics Anonymous and ideas like, can you recover or will you always be recovering? Do you have a choice over alcohol? We spent a long time on the difference between alcoholism and drug addiction. Basically, all this stuff with step one, though, comes down to your own personal finding, your own truth. Step one is about finding your own truth. I got to tell you, I had a lot of confusion when I got here, and I'd been to 10 treatment centers. And I had a degree in psychology, and I had been a therapist in a treatment center up in Lansing. And I didn't know what I was. I knew a lot about alcoholism, and I didn't think I had it. I knew a lot about drug addiction, and I thought that's what I was. I knew a lot about how I felt, and I knew a lot about myself, and it did me absolutely no good. I couldn't stay sober. Knowledge got me nowhere. Information did nothing. Just confused me. I had more to unlearn to get to step one. Sometimes we'll do this, and we'll talk about the simplicity of taking one piece of the first step at a time. Body, mind, and spirit. And basically, for each of those, there's really only basically one question. But sometimes people will come up and they'll say, my God, the first step sounds so complicated, when it's basically just a couple simple questions. And sometimes what feels, and it does, it feels complicated, is filtering through all the stuff that needs to be let go of to get to one simple question. For example, we're going to look this morning from the doctor's opinion to the top of page 23. If you want to mark where we're going to stop looking at the craving, we're going to stop looking at the craving after the first two lines on the top of page 23, where it says the experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. And you'll find pretty much after that, they won't talk much about the craving in this book. They'll talk about booze and they'll talk about drinking a little bit, but pretty much the best stuff that we've been able to find in the groups that we come from to cover the physical craving, the allergy to alcohol, even though these pages will get into some other stuff like in Bill's story and stuff, the best pages we have found are from the doctor's opinion to the top of page 23. We'll call this section 2. We'll call it the body. Excuse me. Basically, by the time we're done, we're basically only going to come down to one question. And here's the question. Does your experience abundantly confirm, right from the top of page 23, right to the bottom of 22, that once you put alcohol in your system, something happens which makes it virtually impossible for you to stop? Shorten that question. Do you lose control over the amount once you start? Even shorten that. Can you control the start? Can you control the amount once you start? And sometimes with just that simple question, it feels really complicated because you got to filter through all this preconceived stuff that I already have in my mind. I used to give lectures on THIQ and neurotransmitters and chemical enzyme reactions in the body of an alcoholic. And to get to step one, I had to literally continue to use that prayer. Dear God, please set aside everything I think I know about alcoholism and this craving and this book and these steps and myself and you, God, so that I can have an open mind and a new experience. I hope those that are here for more than information this weekend tried that prayer in their own words, in their own way this morning.
I'm Mark. I'm an alcoholic. A couple other things that we ask you or introduced you to, I think, that are important to mention is, one is the path of consideration, which means when posed with a question that may challenge a belief system that you had or challenge something you either have or haven't done, to sit with that, to not answer that, that your ego uses an answer to shut off considering anything. We also talked about there's a part of us that must defend itself all the time. And if you hear something that is different from that which you have been doing, that part of you will go into action to defend itself, and you'll start to get angry, and you'll start to get judgmental, and you'll start to get critical, and you will have no new experience behind that. And I talked about a paragraph that's so important in my life today on page 55 of the Big Book. You know, it occurred to me, if you go through this book, you're going to see the word attitude mentioned many times in the book. Matter of fact, when you get to 11th step, for example, it says that prayer and meditation works if you work at it, and it says if you have the proper attitude. And the thought occurred to me today, what is this attitude they keep talking about? Well, the attitude is described on page 55, and basically what it tells me is this. There's three components to it. One, Mark, are you willing on a daily basis to lay aside prejudice? And if you look up the word prejudice in a dictionary, it means preconceived thought or opinion. Mark, are you willing to lay aside prejudice, think honestly, and search deep within yourself, Mark? Search deep within yourself. And the promise is that if I'll do that, I can't fail, and it tells me why. The consciousness of my belief, meaning my relationship with God, will come to me, and I will get the answer. So we introduced you to those two ideas. The path of consideration, proper attitude, is described on page 55 of the Big Book. Something I just want to read a little. It's kind of a little story that ties into what we're going to discuss, powerlessness, and it's called Green Beans. It says, it has occurred to me that even though I like green beans, I do not have a problem, nor am I powerless over green beans. I say this for the following reasons. I cannot tell you the last time I ate green beans and how many I ate. I'm not planning the next time I will eat green beans or how many I will eat. I do not know if I have any green beans in the house, and if so, where they may be. I have never hidden green beans around my house. I have never lied about how many green beans I ate or what I did when I ate them. I have never forgotten what I did after eating green beans. I have never embarrassed or abused myself or my family after eating green beans. I have never stolen money from my employer to pay for green beans. I have never cheated on my wife after eating green beans. I have never been stopped by the police for driving while eating green beans. I have never been unable to stop eating green beans once I started. Now, none of these things has ever occurred as a result of eating green beans, and I think I can safely say that if any of them did occur, I would have serious reservations about ever eating another green bean in my life. And yet all of these things happen when I drink alcohol, and I thought they were perfectly normal. Now we're going to talk about the doctor's opinion. A couple other things that are, I think, important. One is, we've talked about in the Big Book, we're going to take statements and turn them into questions, and Joe and I will show you how to do that. Anytime the book makes a statement, turn it into a question and lay your experience alongside the question to answer it to discover your truth. I've given you the tool of put your name in. Make this book personal. Put your name in. Forget about the word E. Either use your name or use the I word. Pay attention when you see the word if, and pay attention when you see the word it. Know what it means. So a little quick history on Dr. Silkworth. There was an excellent article about Bill Wilson, which was pretty heavily researched, and I found out a lot about Dr. Silkworth in that. And it's estimated that he treated over 51,000 alcoholics and drug addicts in his 16 years at Towns Hospital. And the interesting thing is that in the doctor's opinion, everything he tells us came from observation. He was not doing scientific research on people. Now, here's what's interesting to note. As far as I can tell, in 1995, because I'm in this business, everything that scientists have been able to prove in terms of alcoholism is in complete agreement with what Dr. Silkworth came up with from observation. So we have not been able to disprove a single thing that he said around this thing. So, again, in the doctor's opinion, The place we're going to come at when we look at this is one thing. What happens to me once I take a drink? Or for those of you who are trying to find out your truth around drugs, what happens to me when I put dope in my body? And that's all we're looking at. And what's beautiful is the Big Book disregards everything else your ego might use to not look at the truth. It doesn't care what your gender is, male or female. It doesn't care about your age. It doesn't care about your education. It doesn't care about any of that. It asks one simple question. Mark, you take a little drinky poo of booze, what happens to you? And that's what we're going to look at as we go through the doctor's opinion.
So with this section of the book, section 2, from the doctor's opinion to the top of page 23, we're concerned with what happens after we take a drink, after it goes into our system. And there's really one basic pertinent question you can use to sum up the whole section. And that's, why am I powerless over alcohol physically once I take a drink? We'll break this section into four parts. Part one is the doctor's opinion. And the greatest thing I ever learned about this book, and the greatest thing I ever learned to use this chapter, is when he makes a statement, turn it into a question. And we'll show you as we go through the doctor's opinion how to do that with some pertinent. You can't do it with every statement, but here's how I've kind of felt. I got to this chapter when my sponsor said we'd looked at this as a textbook and we're going to do it in order. And we got to the doctor's opinion. I said, well, what does this guy's opinion have to do with anything?
I mean, who knew Dr. Silkworth anyway? 1939, I mean, more has been revealed. You know, who's this guy? And somebody said, to make this chapter come alive so it's not just a doctor's opinion, turn every statement you can into a question. And the whole chapter came alive because it was a chapter about me. It was a chapter about what happens when I take a drink of alcohol. With Bill's story, we're going to break it into two parts. The first part, we're going to look at the drunk log, which is page 1 through 8, which was his drinking. And we're going to find a way to turn it into a tool for you to look at your drinking. So here's what you do with the first 8 pages of Bill's story. Mark everything you can that you can relate to in 3 different areas. How he thought, how he felt, and how he drank. And all of a sudden, and I've seen women mark 3/4 of his story. For me, I'd never been to war, I'd not a stockbroker, and I'd never been married, and I was marking over 3/4 of his story. Because I wondered when I got to it, what good is putting Bill's story way up here and Dr. Bob's story way in the back? Somebody said, well, because you got to know, when I got sober in Denver, there was 3 of the original members of Alcoholics Anonymous living in Denver when I got sober, and I got to talk to those guys. And I said, how come they put Bill's story way up here and Dr. Bob way back here, if this is a textbook and we're supposedly looking at the physical craving? And he says, well, I'm sure Bill's ego had something to do with it, but at the time, at the time, they felt it was the best story for anybody to relate to. Because it doesn't get into a lot of stuff that separates us. It gets us into a lot of stuff that joins us. And all of a sudden, they said, look for the similarities and put aside the differences. And I brought that principle into meetings, and all of a sudden, guys that I couldn't relate to a week earlier, Skid Row or really rich or not like me or didn't go where I went or didn't go as far as, all of a sudden, I'm listening to how they drank. I'm listening to how they felt. And I'm listening to how they thought. And all of a sudden, guys that I couldn't relate to, including Bill Wilson, when I put aside the differences and looked for the similarities and looked at how they thought and they felt and they drank, all of a sudden I'm relating to people, including Bill Wilson, that I previously didn't relate to. So take that drunkologue and use it as a tool to get in touch with your own drunkologue and mark what you can relate to in those first 8 pages. Then you'll find that he gets sober. So what can we do with his description of sobriety, pages 8 through 16. Well, there you can go back to the exercise that somewhere before step 3 needs to be decided, is if you're willing to go to any length. Because what he's going to describe there in page 8 to 16 is a great short form description of what you're going to be asked to do in the rest of the work. So here's what you do with 9 to 16. Mark anything that you're not willing to do that he did to recover. Anything that pulls on you, anything that you feel resistance to. And it doesn't mean you fail or you can't go on. I'll tell you what that stuff turns into. And it turns into a great tool for you, the person taking me through, and me, the person going through it. Whatever you mark, and be honest, whatever you mark that you feel resistant to, that's the barometer as to when you're done with step 1. Because here's what I'll tell you. When you're done with all 3 parts of step 1, you go back to that resistance that you felt at the beginning, it'll be gone. And the stuff you marked will be a great barometer for the person taking you through and you, the person doing it, as to when you're done with step 1. With 17 to 23, in there is a solution, we're going to use the same principle that we used with the doctor's opinion, and that is continue to turn every statement you possibly can into a question for yourself. Mark talked again about how to approach those questions. Approach the question that you're not meaning to answer it. Approach the question like the most important thing isn't your answer to it. Approach the question from where you can look at it from both sides. And we're going to bring up some specific questions within these pages and show you how to look at both sides of that. Really, the questions taken from statements in this book are presented. We present them to people when we write them out, alcohol, and then we present them drugs. So you can give people you're working with the grace and the dignity to have their own experience and find out whether they're an addict, whether they're an alcoholic, or whether they're both. So if I was working with somebody with a drug history, here's what I mean. I would take them through this entire section from the doctor's opinion to the top of 23 with alcohol, and then I just to see if the craving happens when they drink booze. And then I would take them through this section again, looking at drugs, and by the time we were done with 23, page 23, for the second time, they'd be clear as far as physically, are they alcoholic, addict, or both? And then when we look at the mental obsession, that'll settle the question once and for all.
In the doctor's opinion, I'm going to start going through some things here, and again, because of time, we aren't going to read everything. I want to read the opening sentence, then I'm going to turn to another page, but it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous believe the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in the book. So the recovery, the plan of recovery is going to be described to me in this book, is where I'm going to find it. Now, I'll use that as an example to show you how you turn a statement into a question. Mark, are you interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book? And I ask myself that question. Consider that. Yeah, I'm interested in that. If you'll turn over to the next page, XXIV, I'm going to hit a few highlights on stuff, go over some stuff, and then Joe will talk about some things here. It says, the physician who at our request gave us this letter, he's been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. So I ask myself this question. Based on my experience with alcohol, have I suffered alcoholic torture? Do I believe that my body is quite as abnormal as my mind? Goes on to say, it did not satisfy Mark to be told he couldn't control his drinking because he was maladjusted to life, that Mark was in full flight from reality or outright mental defectives. Trying to show you how it works when you put your name in. These things were true to some extent, in fact to a considerable extent with Mark, but we're sure that Mark's body was sickened as well. Mark, do you think your body was sickened as well? In our belief, any picture of Mark which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that Mark has an allergy to alcohol interests us. Now, the other point I want to mention, if you haven't used a dictionary as you've gone through this book, I'm going to strongly suggest that you do that, that you understand what these words mean. It says, as a layman, our opinion as to its, what's it, the allergy, may mean little, but as an ex-problem drinker, we can say that his, the doctor's explanation, makes good sense. It, the allergy, may explain many things for which Mark cannot otherwise account. Now I want to give you an example of what I try and get people to do. 1978, my grandmother was living in Iowa when she passed away, and this is a woman who loved me and a lot and did a lot for me. And I got a phone call, and I had 3 days to get from Anchorage, Alaska, back to Iowa. And I got on the plane, and I ordered a drink, and 6 days later, I woke up in St. Louis, Missouri. And I didn't plan on being in St. Louis, Missouri, and I didn't want to be in St. Louis, Missouri. I wanted to be at that funeral to show respect for my grandmother, and I needed to be at the funeral, and I intended to be at the funeral, but I took a drink of alcohol and I never made it to the funeral, and I had that happen to me hundreds of times, and I had people look at the times these things happened to them, because when I begin to look at the idea that I have an allergy to alcohol, when I take one, it activates craving in me, all of a sudden I got an answer for behavior I'd exhibited for many years that I could never, never explain. You see, because I had tremendous guilt, shame, and remorse about not showing up at my grandmother's funeral. You understand what the book's trying to say? It, the allergy, can explain many things to you, Mark, which you've never been able to have explained to you. Mark, you're not a bad person. You're not any of that, Mark. What you have is a physical allergy. When you put it in your body, look at the idea that when you take one, it the rest takes you, and you're going to go wherever it takes you. Now, turn over to the top of page XXVI. This is a real important paragraph to turn some statements into questions. It says, we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, the action of alcohol on Mark is a manifestation of an allergy. Do I believe that? That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never, highlight the word never, never occurs in an average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they couldn't break it, so I asked myself a question. Based on my experience with booze, did I form the habit and found I couldn't break it? Yeah, I did. Once having lost their self-confidence. Well, based on my experience, Mark, did you lose your self-confidence, your ability to break this habit? Yeah. Their reliance upon things human. Mark, did you, based on your experience, did you lose your reliance upon things human? Mark's problems pile up in him, become astonishing and difficult to solve. Now, I've tested this many times. You take a normal drinker and ask a normal drinker these questions, and they're going to give you a totally different set of answers. The reason I answered yes to all these, I discovered, is because I have a physical allergy to alcohol. Goes on to say, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. My own or anybody else's. Go back into your experience. The times you've said to yourself, I want to control it. I don't want to drink again. Did you? The message which can interest and hold alcoholic people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they're going to recreate their lives, which is also a great promise. Now, the bottom of the page. Mark drinks essentially because he likes the effect produced by alcohol. See, I had to get clear on why I drank. I mean, I love it when someone says they drank for taste. I mean, the best tasting drink in the world is cold, clear water, but I don't drink a case at a time. The sensation, meaning this effect that I get, is so elusive that while Mark admits it's injurious, again, remember I told you, you got to know what the word it means. It here means this effect. Why does Mark drink? Mark cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To Mark, his alcoholic life seemed the only normal one. Mark is restless, irritable, and discontented, and unless he can again experience a sense of ease and comfort effect, which comes at once by taking a few drinks which Mark sees others taking with impunity. Now again, I'm looking at my experience, okay, and laying it alongside this paragraph. After Mark succumbs to the desire again, meaning to drink, as Mark will so often do, I take a drink, the phenomenon of craving develops, Mark will pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. Mark repeats this over and over, and I'd ask myself, did you do this? And the first time I went through and I put my name in here, I'm saying, my God, this is me. And unless Mark can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of Mark's recovery. Dr. Silkworth uses the term psychic change. Carl Jung uses the term spiritual experience. And then it goes on to say, on the other hand, strange as this may seem to those who don't understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being required to follow a few simple rules. Mark, are you willing to follow a few simple rules? Goes on a little bit further down and says, one feels something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. So I go back into my experience and I start asking myself about human power. See, the path of consideration told me this. If I'm going to look at being powerless, I need to look at power. Here's the definition of power. Ability to act, capacity. So I look at my experience, and here's what I say. When I take a drink of alcohol, do I have the ability to determine if I'm going to take another drink or not? And I lay my experience alongside the idea of power, and I see that I have no power once I take the first drink. So now, if I don't have power, now I can go to the other side and look at powerlessness and say to myself what happens. The other thing I want to share with you that my experience confirmed is sometimes two drinks satisfied my craving. It wasn't like I had to take a drink and drink a case every single time or a fifth. I begin to see the progressive nature of this illness. As I looked at me and alcohol, I begin to see that as I get older, it took greater and greater amounts of alcohol to satisfy my craving. Sometimes my craving was satisfied in two drinks, but some of you can probably relate, the older I got, it took large, more and huge quantities of alcohol to satisfy the craving. Joe?
Let's look at a paragraph on back. Let's go back a couple pages to XXV. And the paragraph starts off three paragraphs down. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good which lie outside our synthetic knowledge. Today I still read that and I haven't a clue what they're saying. I do not comprehend that paragraph for some reason until two words were explained to me. Actually, three words. The first word is Dr. Silkworth's use of the word moral psychology. That's his way of saying spiritual experience. He also uses in the last sentence the word powers of good. They told me that means the power of God. And then I should change every time they use the word our, O-U-R, they're talking about doctors. Now let's read the paragraph. Look how simple it is now. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of a spiritual experience is of urgent importance to alcoholics, but the application of a spiritual experience presented difficulties beyond a doctor's conception. What with doctors' ultra-modern standards, doctors' scientific approach to everything, doctors are perhaps not well equipped to apply the power of God that lies outside their synthetic knowledge. Simple. They know what we need and they can't apply it. You're going to find Carl Jung says the same thing about the mind that Dr. Silkworth says about the body. They know exactly what we need. He calls it, I think, in another place here in this chapter, essential psychic change, right? Here he calls it moral psychology. That's a doctor's way of saying what a lot of people have known for a long time that you and I need is a spiritual experience. But then they go on to admit they can't make it happen for us. This is just another long line in admissions that no human power, including Dr. Silkworth, the foremost authority, the guy that had the piece of information that saved Bill and Bob and a lot of us, finally finding out. Can you think of all those days that it ties up that you could never explain when Silkworth says, hey, you got an allergy to alcohol. Instead of like a rash to strawberries where you get a rash every time you eat strawberries, instead of that, you get a craving for more alcohol beyond your mental control. That'd be like saying you're going to eat a quart of strawberries and this time I'm not going to get a rash. This time I'm not going to get a rash. This time I'm not going to get a rash as that rash appears on your skin, right? That's Dr. Silkworth saying the same thing. You and I thinking that we can control the amount of booze we drink once it goes into our system because of an allergic reaction would be like sitting there and saying, this time I'm not going to drink anymore. This time I'm not going to drink anymore. This time I'm not going to drink anymore. He makes a statement on the top of page XXVIII. I hate that this chapter is not numbered. I hate that. He makes a statement that...
Page 27, but it's really not Jesus. 27.
28.
28, yeah. We're on page 28, but we're not at page 1 yet.
Right. Only an alcoholic would understand that. He says, these men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. That doesn't mean you and I never drank to escape. Everybody in this room probably drank to escape something or someone or some feeling or something, right? But he's talking about times, if you look on the previous page, he's looking at times where a business deal or something was going to be decided in our favor and things were going well, and the times where you were feeling good, nobody to get away from, no one to get rid of, nothing to escape. Go back to those times where you weren't drinking to escape. You were drinking to escape a craving beyond your own control.
Once we take a drink, he's trying to have us look at our experience. Mark, does your experience confirm this craving has more power than your mind to stop picking up the drink? Example is, I wanted to be at that funeral. Another time I'm living with a lady, I go to a store to get some milk. I stop at Bennigan's, I have a drink. 8 days later, I wake up in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Okay? I did this, I can't tell you how many times. And when I begin to get introduced to this idea of craving, I begin to see why I did all of that. I begin to see that once I take a drink, the drink's going to take me. And now I have to come face to face with something. On this same page, they describe five types of alcoholics. And then they do something at the bottom of this page, which I like. And that is that they bring us all back together again instead of separating us. And here's what they tell us. All of these drinkers and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing this phenomenon called craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, is the manifestation of an allergy. It will differentiate these people and set me apart as a distinct entity. It, this allergy, has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest from the allergy is entire abstinence. Now they go on to tell us this puts us into a cauldron of debate, and here's why we're going to find out why. Dr. Silkworth told Bill what was wrong with him. Said, Bill, it's real simple. If you never take a drink, you'll never activate allergy. Now you go on and have a good life. Bill would come back to town's hospital damn near dead. Doc Silkworth would look at him and say, what the hell is wrong with you? I told you what was wrong with you. That's why they put us in a cauldron of debate. They told us, here's the state of hopelessness for all of us in this room. My experience abundantly confirms that I have a physical allergy to alcohol, and knowing that will not prevent me from picking up a drink, which is why, in the doctor's opinion, they tell us, Mark, this puts us into a debate, and basically you're doomed. Because knowing that you can never drink alcohol from a standpoint of being able to control or moderate will not prevent you from picking up a drink. It's like Joe said, if I ate strawberries and broke out into a rash and damn near died, I guarantee you I have a mental defense that I would never eat strawberries again. I have no mental defense against alcohol. My experience abundantly confirms that. I damn near died, I don't know how many times, from alcohol poisoning, yet I kept picking up alcohol again, thinking I wasn't going to die from alcoholic poisoning.
With Bill's story, you'll go through the first 8 pages and you'll find your own stuff that you relate to. Some of the things that stand out for me is on the first page is that I was part of life when I discovered liquor. Ominous warnings which I failed to heed. Next page, out of this alloy and drink and speculation, I commenced to forge a weapon that would one day turn in its flight like a boomerang and cut me to ribbons.
Remember at the front of Bill's story, right in the words, think, drink, feel. As you go back through this work, any time that you think like Bill, drink like Bill, or feel like Bill, I want you to highlight that.
My drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. Liquor, on page 5, liquor ceased to be a luxury, it became a necessity. Bottom of that paragraph, I still thought I could control the situation. There were periods of sobriety which renewed my hope. Gradually, things got worse. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could take no much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I'd written a lot of sweet promises, but my family happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. Shortly afterwards, I was drunk. Most people find that on page 8, when Bill really describes his final bottom, they usually mark every word of it. And it's a paragraph that says, paragraph 2, no words can tell the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I met my match. I'd been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. Continue to turn those statements into questions, but first, find the ones that you relate to. Find the ones that describe how you felt, how you thought, and how you drank. Then bring the principle from the doctor's opinion into your drunkologue and look at your drunkologue totally focused on, do I lose control over the amount once I start? Then, when we're in the middle of the obsession between 23 and 43, come back to Bill's story again and look at your drunkologue again from the point of view, can I keep myself stopped once I stop? So look at the first 8 pages of Bill's story twice. Look at it when you're in the craving, to look at your drunkologue from the point of view of the craving, and then look at it again when you're between 23 and 43 to look at the mental obsession. We could go into long stories about our drunkologue, but I'll tell you, I drank for 18 years, and I'll tell you, from the first time I drank, almost every single time that I ever drank, I lost control over the amount. I can find few times where I only had a few. But here's a great question for those of you, because there's always someone in the room that was a periodic. Now here's a binge drinker. Now here's a great question for you. You see there was times when there was control. And you see where there was times when there wasn't control. Here's the only question you need to answer. Were you the one in charge of when there was control and when there wasn't? And if you weren't, there wasn't any control, because you weren't the one calling the shots. This is about power over alcohol. This is really about admitting that I don't have any power over alcohol physically once I put it in my system. But we're going to find a weird paradox here. To admit that you're powerless over alcohol, let's look at maybe you're not to find out you really are. By that, here's what I mean. When we get to the top of 23, we'll take the question. Does my experience abundantly confirm that once I put alcohol in my system, I lose control over the amount once I start? Does my experience abundantly confirm that? Maybe it doesn't. Go back to your experience and try to find out that you're not alcoholic. Try to pull out that you're not powerless over alcohol, and it might take you to that you really are. It's a weird first step paradox. With the next 8 pages of Bill's story, and then I'll ask Mark to talk about this chapter a little bit, you're looking at things you're not willing to do that Bill did to recover, because what you get in 9 to 16, what you get in 9 to 16 is a great brief description of the rest of the recovery process in this book. You'll find things like, after Ebby comes to see him, you'll find things like on page 13, there I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. If that currently pulls on you, mark it. I admitted here's the one that gets me when my ego has rebuilt itself and it's time for me to go through the work again. I admitted again for the first time that of myself I am nothing and that without God I'm lost. I usually feel some resistance to that when I'm at the beginning of the work, so I mark it. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away, root and branch. I've not had a drink since.
Step 6 and 7.
My schoolmate visited me and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies.
Step 5.
Made a list of people I had hurt and toward whom I felt resentment. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Step 9. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability. I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. So all the way through these next 8 pages, 9 to 16 in Bill's story, you're going to find stuff that's required to recover. Mark it if you feel resistant to it. Anything else with this chapter?
No, let's get into chapter 2. There is a solution. I want to hit a few highlights from 17 to 23 that I think are important. Starts out, says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who are once as hopeless as Bill. So the exercise we gave you in the first 8 pages is to answer this question. Mark, based on your experience with alcohol, were you as hopeless as Bill? And when I marked how I think, drink, and felt, and I saw that Bill and I were exactly alike when it came to alcohol. I thought like Bill, I felt like Bill, and I drank like Bill. So I have to answer this question, was I as hopeless as Bill? Yeah. Then I get a great, great statement of hope. Nearly all have recovered. They've solved the drink problem. Now, the next paragraph describes the fellowship, but toward the bottom, I want you to make notes on a couple things. It says, the feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us. I want you to write in your big book, page 75. And the reason I want to do that is when you get done doing a fifth step, the instructions in the book are that you go home and spend an hour alone, and you're going to answer some questions. And if you don't understand the cement, you're going to think the people who wrote this book are nuts, because it's going to ask you about this cement. You need to understand about cement. It goes on to say, but that in itself, this one element, this common peril, would never have held us together as we're now joined. Tremendous fact for every one of us. We've discovered a common solution. We have a way out in which we can absolutely agree.
So there's two parts to this cement. Sharing in a common problem.
What's wrong with this?
And sharing in a common solution.
Yeah.
If all you and I needed was to sit in rooms with people that had our same problem, the county jail would have worked for several of us. Imagine those of you in the room that are new, if all you could do was sit around rooms and hear people talking about having the same problem that you do, but no one in the room had a solution to that problem. So there's two things that join us. This stuff doesn't seem real important now. It will after a fifth step when they ask you to review this cement. Picture this. Picture a brick wall that has your first step. That's the foundation of your entire program, is this foundation that you're laying right now in step 1. And then imagine that we're going to build an arch, starting with one stone at step 2, all the way up to the top of the arch at step 3, down to the bottom of the arch when you're done. and the steps are going to be this archway to freedom. Well, right now we're mixing the cement that's going to hold the entire foundation of your program so it never has to fall any further. As screwed up as I can get, it'll never fall any further than I'm alcoholic. I cannot keep myself sober. My first step. Now we're mixing the cement that holds the whole foundation of your program together. Let's go to the bottom of page 20 and look at three types of drinkers. Guy told me once the bottom of this page describes three types of alcoholics. It doesn't. It describes three types of drinkers. First of all, they're going to say there's a moderate drinker who has little trouble giving up liquor entirely if he has a good reason for it. He can take it or leave it alone. Turn those statements into questions, and probably no one in this room except the Al-Anons will find that they're moderate drinkers. I've never had a problem seeing that I'm definitely not a moderate drinker. I have a lot of trouble giving it up, and I cannot take it or leave it alone without losing control. But let's look at how similar I am to the hard drinker. We have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit, mark the word, a habit for alcohol. He might have this habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It might even cause him to die a few years before his time. But if a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, warning of a doctor, and then think of some of your own. I think of the more positive ones too, wealth, education, opportunity, schooling. If one of these sufficiently strong reasons becomes operative, this man can stop or moderate, even though he might find it difficult and troublesome and might even need medical attention. There's people in this room that think anybody who has a drinking problem is alcoholic, and anybody that alcohol kills would definitely be alcoholic, and anybody that alcohol impairs physically and mentally must surely be alcoholic. This paragraph says that's not true. Only 10% of the population is alcoholic, and there's a lot of hard drinkers that can drink some of you and I under the table as far as the amount. They might have a habit for alcohol. It might even impair them physically and mentally. But given a sufficiently strong reason, they can make up their mind and stop. So there's the first point that separates me from the hard drinker. Give me a sufficiently strong reason, I drink. As a matter of fact, your sufficiently strong reason to stop is my sufficiently strong reason to start. And I've got guys throughout my life, they seem to be able to stop when such and such happened, when we went to the penitentiary, when we got in trouble that first time, and I made up my mind to stop and I couldn't. Well, what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as the first guy we read about. Some of us did, some of us didn't. Here's an interesting statement. He may or may not even become as bad as the guy we just read about, the hard drinker. But at some stage of my drinking career, I began to lose control over the amount once I start. There's the number two point. So far, there's only two things that separate me from the hard drinker. Give him a sufficient reason he can stop. Give me a sufficient reason I start again. And at some stage of my drinking, I began to lose control over the amount once I start.
The other thing that's important, it's the things that we've just talked about eliminate this stuff about how old I am, how much I drank, how often I drank. The book doesn't care about any of that. It asks you to look at one simple thing. People who are periodics and people who are binge drinkers, they'll hang their hat on that. Well, I didn't drink for 9 months. I drank for three and damn near died, right? The book eliminates all that. It asks you a simple question. Does your experience confirm you can control once you start? It doesn't care what you drink, how long you drink, how often you drink. And for me, it was important. It eliminated my idea that an alcoholic was someone sleeping under a bridge. Because the truth is, about 98% of the population who are alcoholic are people that are sitting in this room, that are married and they have jobs and they have children and everything else. So I looked at one simple thing, not how much I drank and how often. When I take a drink, could I control it? Did I have sufficient reason? I mean, here, think about this. Those of you who've gone through this thing of trying to quit, imagine you made a list of all the consequences you suffered from drinking. And so then what happened, I do this a lot with people who've relapsed. I'll say to them, do you think, guy sober a year, for example, do you think you chose to drink? And he or she will always say yes. And I'll say to him, you don't have a clue about step one. Because if you and I made a list of all the consequences we suffered from drinking, and we went into one of those malls where they do this survey, okay? And what we did, we pulled somebody over and said, listen, when I take a drink of alcohol, this is what's happened to me. And they look at this. It's about 2 pages long, right? And they get done reading. I say to them, here's the question. The reason I'm asking you this is I'm thinking of taking a drink again. What do you think? They had run like hell to get away from you. You see? So again, what am I looking at here? When I take a drink, does a drink take me? So let's go on again to the bottom of page 22. We know that while Mark keeps away from drink, as Mark may do for months or years, Mark will react much like other men, physically, right? We are equally positive once Mark takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system. I like the word any alcohol. I hope there's no near beer drinkers in here. Something will happen, both in the bodily and mental sense, which will make it impossible for Mark to stop. Does Mark's experience abundantly confirm this? And then right in your big book, looking at the body stops. The big book only spends 33 pages, and part of that's Bill's story, looking at this physical allergy. You know why? Because alcohol's not our problem. That's why. From page 23 to 164, the book is not going to talk to me about having alcohol in my body, which takes us into the next thing we're going to look at, pages 23 to 43, the mental obsession. The state of mind that we're all in this morning. What in God's name would propel us? If we looked at our experience and found our truth, and our truth is we can't control it, we can't control it because of the allergy. The book says, Mark, all this information about the allergy would be academic and pointless if you never took another drink. So here's what we have to think about. In order for any one of us in this room to ever activate the physical craving, something's got to happen in our mind to convince us to leave here and get in the car and go buy booze and take a drink. Therefore, the main problem centers in my mind rather than in my body. You see? You see what the book's trying to say? And knowing that we have a physical allergy based on our experience, that we're never going to be successful drinking alcohol, the bad news, folks, is that won't keep us from picking up a drink.
You can't be 5, 10, 15, 20 years sober sitting in a meeting without any alcohol in your system craving booze. It sounds like semantics, and it pretty much is, but it's important you